But we're going to read about the Lord's lotus feet again. Continued. What did we hear about the Lord's lotus feet yesterday? Very good. So especially considering we're lacking in each of those areas, it's a good place to go. Now, this morning's verse says there's obstacles in going there. The obstacle, primary obstacle mentioned is too much affected by materialistic activities. And when that happens, one's internal vision, antar manasa, or internal mind, our capacity to look within, becomes disturbed or distorted. And so then we can't see the lotus feet of the Lord. We can't properly meditate upon the lotus feet of the Lord. It's a problem. Specifically, it says those persons who are offensive. So it's one thing to have that obstacle. It's another thing to be offensive. In the purport, the offensiveness is impersonalism. Specifically, how one regards the Supreme Lord, as one regards him as impersonal. Then that obstacle can't be removed, and conversely, if that's not an obstacle, then the shortcomings that we have can be removed by that sadhana, the practice of remembering the lotus feet of the Lord, or concentrating or meditating upon the lotus feet of the Lord. It's particularly relevant that the demigods are speaking this way. Go back to the beginning, before they began offering their prayers. They've been created. They know that they have some service to do, and they feel not capable of doing that service. So that can be one of us too. We're created, we have some service to do, we may not feel capable of doing our service. So they're offering prayers. And they're recognizing, as we should also recognize, there's an obstacle in doing our service nicely for Krishna, and that is our attachments. And there's big ones, there's small ones, and there's medium-sized ones. We have different attachments. It makes it, it's an obstacle in becoming empowered or capable of doing the service that's provided for us to do. Particularly from a spiritual perspective. Meaning, maybe we can do our homework, but to be Krishna conscious, to do what we have to do, mindful of Krishna. Like the verse that I referred to yesterday, Matirna Krishna Paratak Svatova. If one is a Griha Vrata, one who's attached to the body, and the pleasures, the affairs of the body, and that's one's absorption, then one's Krishna consciousness won't awaken. So here, the demigods are praying, O great Supreme Lord, offensive persons whose internal vision has been too affected by external materialistic activities cannot see your lotus feet. But they are seen by your pure devotees whose one and only aim is to transcendentally enjoy your past, your activities. A nice purport. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 18:61, the Lord is situated in everyone's heart. It is natural, therefore, that one should be able to see the Lord, at least within himself. But that is not possible for those whose internal vision has become covered by external activities. So this phrase is in the verse, the internal vision, external activities. Here it is in the purport. It's going to come again at the end of the purport. So the middle is just expanding on what's that internal vision and external activities. Attachment, too much attachment to external activities. The pure soul, who is symptomized by consciousness, can be easily perceived, even by a common man, because consciousness is spread all over the body. After the class yesterday evening, that was one of the questions that a group of students were asking. What's consciousness? So same, just as Prabhupada is presenting here. Consciousness is that which spreads, it's of the soul, concomitant with the soul, is Prabhupada's phrase. So as where there's sun, there's sunshine. Where there's a soul, there's consciousness. Consciousness is inseparable from the soul. You're not going to find consciousness without a soul or soul without consciousness. Maybe a covered state of consciousness, but consciousness is a symptom of the soul. The yoga system, as recommended in Bhagavad Gita, is to concentrate the mental activities internally and thus see the lotus feet of the Lord within oneself. But there are many so-called yogis who have no concern with the Lord, but are only concerned with consciousness, which they accept as the final realization. Impersonalism. Such realization of consciousness sounds mystical. Is taught by Bhagavad Gita within only a few minutes, whereas the so-called yogis take continuous years to realize it because of their offensiveness at the lotus feet of the Lord. The greatest offense is to deny the existence of the Lord as separate from the individual souls, or to accept the Lord and the individual soul as one and the same. So the second is the more common version. And it's not just like yogis off in the Himalayas somewhere. I just received a letter yesterday from an American middle-aged man who is finding this to be a problem in the course of his devotional service, because he's read so many books, too many books, and the idea of, you know, ultimately, you know the phrase, right? Become one. So what that means, he doesn't really know, but he kind of bought into the phrase because it sounds nice. And there's so many people writing about it. Become one. And that concept is poison as far as awakening Krishna consciousness is concerned. So the next sentence, the last sentence of the first paragraph, is The impersonalists misinterpret the theory of reflection, and thus they wrongly accept the individual consciousness as the supreme consciousness. So, as college students, you'll love this one. Here's a new theory. You can try to wrap your brain around the theory of reflection. You heard of that one before? What's the theory of reflection?
What I have, the sun being reflected in all the different parts, then say that it's the same thing.
Okay. That's a different one, but than the one that's here. But that's fine. Another one is in the banyan tree. When I first read the theory of reflection, I thought that's what it was referring to. Because the impersonalists say, just see, where is there a tree where the roots are growing up and the branches are growing down? There isn't one, and therefore it's illusion. It just doesn't exist. What this material world is false. It doesn't exist. The pots with reflection of the sun on the water in the pots is another one. Looks like so many, their idea is it looks like so many suns, but we know it's only one sun. And similarly, it may look like there's only so many, there's so many souls, but there's only one, Brahman and Aham Brahmasmi. Ta-da, I'm God. And then all other verses or of Bhagavad Gita and all the teachings just get kind of like, you know, twist it around so they can connect with that one. I'm God. So here's a different version of the theory of reflection of the Supreme. The theory of the reflection of the Supreme can be clearly understood without difficulty by any sincere common man. When there is a reflection of the sky on the water, so especially the sky at night, because it's going to speak of stars. Both the sky and the stars are seen within the water, but it is understood that the sky and the stars are not to be accepted on the same level. The stars are parts of the sky, and therefore they cannot be equal to the whole. The sky is the whole, and the stars are the parts. They cannot be one and the same. Transcendentalists who do not accept the supreme consciousness as separate from the individual consciousness are as offensive as the materialists who deny even the existence of the Lord. Theory of reflection. So it's the whole and the part, the sky and the stars. So how the theory of reflection, or the metaphor of reflection, is properly understood is very clear. How it's improperly understood is difficult. The sky is the whole, and stars are the parts. They cannot be one and the same. The transcendentalists who do not accept the supreme consciousness as separate from the individual consciousness are as offensive as the materialists who deny even the existence of the Lord. So, impersonalists and atheists are, according to this sentence, equally offensive. paragraph. Such offenders cannot actually see the lotus feet of the Lord within themselves, nor are they even able to see the devotees of the Lord. The devotees of the Lord are so kind that they roam to all places to enlighten people in God consciousness. The offenders, however, lose the chance to receive the Lord's devotees, although the offenseless common man is at once influenced by the devotee's presence. Then he tells the Magari story. He became a devotee. But the offenders, Nalakuvara and Manigriva, even though living amongst the demigods, had to undergo the punishment of becoming trees in their next life, although by the grace of a devotee, they were later delivered by the Lord. So he goes through that again. There's the idea here is that if there's a fundamental misconception that one takes shelter of, an impersonal conception that a priori there's not a supreme and we're the parts of the supreme. If that disappears and we are the supreme, or there's this oneness, absolute oneness between us and the supreme, then trying to meditate upon the lotus feet of the Lord isn't going to, one is an offender. And, in turn, one will also be attached to materialistic activities, that is, seeing things separate from the Lord, whatever those activities are. Offenders have to wait until they receive the mercy of the devotees, and then they can become eligible to see the lotus feet of the Lord within themselves. So, you know, anticipating some questions about, you know, I've got this shortcoming and that shortcoming, this problem and this attachment and so forth. The key of the verse is through the mercy of the devotees. But then one will not be able to even see the devotees if one is too much attached to materialism, or if one is has a fundamental offensive misconception about God, impersonal conception. Offenders have to wait until they receive the mercy of the devotees, and then they can become eligible to see the lotus feet of the Lord within themselves. But due to their offenses and their extreme materialism, they cannot even see the devotees of the Lord. Engaged in external activities, they kill the internal vision, which is what the verse is saying. Asat vritibi akshibi. Asat is illusion. Sat and asat. Vritibi means those who are influenced by the external energy. Akshibi, their senses become incapable of perceiving. But then one can properly perceive if one's internal vision is directed towards the Supreme, but one's internal vision will be clouded or distorted, disturbed, if there's too much attachment for the external materialistic activities. And that's due to, it stays like that. We may be, one more time, we may have those struggles, shortcomings, etc. But provided we haven't taken shelter of some impersonal offensive conception, the process of bhakti can gradually bring us out of that condition. And that process of bhakti comes through the mercy of the devotees. Then go back through the loop one more time. But those who are too much attached, they just don't want to let go of their materialistic activities. they can't properly see the devotee or receive the mercy of the devotee. Or those that have some offensive towards the Lord conception, an impersonal conception, they can't take the mercy of the devotees properly. However, the Lord's devotees do not mind the offenses of the foolish in their many gross and subtle body endeavors. The Lord's devotees continue to bestow the blessings of devotional service upon all such offenders without hesitation. That is the nature of the devotees. The theory of reflection. So, just to do it one more time. The greatest offense is to deny the existence of the Lord as separate from the individual souls. You know, it's like saying, using this metaphor, the sky and the stars are not separate. I don't know how they can even try to say like that. So, impersonal pill, poison pill, is to say, actually, there's no such thing as individuality. The starting point is it's all one. So to work off of it's all one, there's this silly notion that people have that we have individuality. But there is no such thing as individuality. All there is one thing. All there is Brahman. So this idea of individuality is covered Brahman. And all you have to do is break the covering and you realize you're Brahman. Break this attachment to the idea that you're an individual. Break the clay pot and the light comes out of the clay pot because there's light inside. But it looks like an individual, but it's just light. And all there is light, or all there is Brahman. So it's all one. Just free yourself. You know, some things that sound like our teaching. Free yourself from upadis, the designations that you're this or you're that. And recognize who you are. And who are you? You're Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi. See? I'm Brahman. And you're Brahman. We're all Brahman. The idea that there's Paramatma, that's silly. There's no Atma either, that's silly. All there is Brahman. Those terms, Paramatma, Atma, it's just derivations of Brahman. There's no distinction. All there is Brahman. And you just have to realize it. The goal of life is to realize that you're Brahman. So in such a state, there's no question of bhakti, because with bhakti, there has to be the servitor and the served, and the process of service. So they dismiss bhakti. That's silly. You can do bhakti, that's okay. As for weak-minded people that don't understand, it's all one. And you can do it for a while, and you know, with the rarefied goodness of Krishna, you can become like that's, you know, Brahman in a very elevated state. Or, you know, there's this covering in a very elevated state. But then you can just like dismiss bhakti and dismiss the object of bhakti and you just realize you're Brahman. Because the goal is one. Oneness. So, all of that that I just spoke is all offensive. And one who buys into that offensive notion finds great difficulty on the path of devotional service. So Prabhupada is saying here, they've wrongly understood the theory of reflection. And their idea of the theory of reflection is the sky and the stars in the sky are not separate. It's just part of what the sky is. The sky is, there's the sky with stars in the sky. That's what the sky is. There's not separate stars. Anyway, it's kind of silly. But because they're very strongly attached to a particular, it's like, you know, a scientist that doesn't want to look at the information, he wants to have the information prove his theory or thesis. And so they just, data that doesn't fit in with their theory, they just dismiss it or something, because it has to prove their theory. So there's, with this predisposition that says it's all one, then all verses, all teachings, everything, all experiences, all are put in that same light. It's all one. Such a person cannot possibly see the Lord's lotus feet, even he's within the heart. There's a nice verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakale ashanta. One cannot be peaceful provided there are any one of these three categories of desires. Bhukti, material enjoyment. Mukti, liberation. Siddhi, desire for mystic siddhis. I've heard Prabhupada describe this verse like hundreds of times. As long as there's a desire that says, I want material enjoyment, liberation, or mystic cities, it's I want or I want or I want, and as long as that desire, fruitive desire, even the desire for liberation is a fruitive desire, it's I want out of here. One is I want to be here, and the other is I don't want to be here. And the center is my enjoyment. This is my enjoyment this way or my enjoyment that way. It's, then the mind cannot be peaceful. But the other half of the verse is, when the mind is absorbed in considering Krishna's pleasure, then it's that selfishness, the agitation of self-interest, false self-interest, is dismissed. It's just like the light of a firefly or a glowworm in the midday sun. What's the, just like it was, it's been a full moon from my window in the room out there. It's been last two nights, nearly a full moon or just after the full moon. And it's really bright. It's almost like, you know, a street lamp. It gives a lot of light. But as the sun rises, the brightness of the moon is diminished. Not that the brightness of the moon is diminished, it's just the contrast of the light from the moon in darkness and the light from the moon in daylight is not the same. The contrast is not the same. So gradually, and it just, then it fades. You can't even see the moon anymore. Or it looks like another, just like a little puff of cloud in the sky. Except it's round. So, the apparent, similarly, the apparent brilliance of the notion of oneness that people get very excited about impersonalists get very excited about and absorbed in, its brilliance diminishes as the presence of Krishna appears, because he's the very source of that Brahman effulgence. He's the basis and support of it. But impersonalists, they're so unfortunate, and those who have become contaminated by impersonal philosophy are so unfortunate, that even in Krishna's presence they can't take advantage, or even a devotee of Krishna's presence, they can't take advantage of devotional service. When you can't take advantage of devotional service, you're on your own. Besides, it's lonely to be on your own. It's weaker. One can be broken more easily. And thus, common is persons who go to the mountains to engage in meditation and become enlightened. And then after some time they come back, they descend the mountain and come into society and do philanthropic work. Again, Prabhupada would speak about this so many times. If their notion is the world is false, they give up the world on the basis that it's false, and afterwards they come back and engage in the false, because they have to do something, because the soul is active. So they do philanthropic work. And in this world they're praised. Oh, this wonderful yogi sadhu is doing this hospital work or education work or feeding people or something. And it certainly is, from humanitarian perspective, it's very nice. But from a transcendental perspective, it's... what's the right word? It's hypocrisy. The world is false. Become enlightened and come back and engage in the false. We don't say that the world is false. They say it is. That's their philosophy. Because it's false because there can only be one thing. Brahman. So if there's only one thing, Brahman, then why are you engaged in philanthropy? Because they have to do something. Because they're an individual that has desire and wants activity. So what's the natural activity for the soul in the liberated state? Serving God. But just take that directly, serving God. But don't say the world is false, and don't say there's no God. All there is Brahman. Be honest, don't be a hypocrite. So back to the demigods, they want protection from the merciful Lord through the agency of his lotus feet. They recognize they have mixed desires. They're devotees, but they're mixed devotees. They're not shuddha bhaktas. If they were shuddha bhaktas, they wouldn't become demigods. They'd be in Vaikuntha. So they have material desire, and they want protection from those material desires, and they don't want those material desires to block their vision of the Lord's lotus feet. And so in particular, they're cautious about offenses. And one last time, the greatest offense is to deny the existence of the Lord as separate from the individual soul, or to accept the Lord and the individual soul as one and the same. Okay, gonna end there. See if we have some discussion. Yes?
Can weak-heartedness be one flavor of impersonalism as far as devotion?
Not exactly. Arjuna is told by Krishna, you know, this is your problem. According to Harinam Chintamani, Bhaktivinoda Thakur takes the same weak-heartedness, Hridaya Dorbalyam, and says it's one of the anarthas that block our chanting of the pure holy name. But it's not impersonalism. It's, I know what to do, but I don't do it, due to weak-heartedness. You know, it's, there's some attachment to this thing that I know that is useless. So I don't, but I don't discard it. It's not the same as impersonalism. It's some type of a mood of enjoying something. In Arjuna's case, it was enjoy the kingdom in the association of his relatives. What's the use of having the kingdom if the persons I would want to enjoy the kingdom with, I've just killed them to get the kingdom? Not going to be very enjoyable. So he was hesitating. Hridaya Dorbalyam. Weakness of heart. Anything else?
So speaking, I have two thoughts for you.
Okay.
First one is, I have this tendency or challenge of seeing devotees where they all should have the same capacity, or, you know, the way they do things, as if they are coming from an industry where production kind of a thing, but everyone is. And I was thinking that that's, can I say that that's, you know, that utopian vision where there is no differences, there is all the same, that seems like that's an offshoot of this impersonal tendency.
At least mechanistic.
That's one challenge.
Well, life should be a good instructor. It's not like that. It's one of the beauties of God's creation, is there is so much diversity. One of the things that Prabhupada liked to speak about is there's no two snowflakes alike. And there's a lot of snowflakes, but there's no two snowflakes alike. So what to speak of people? You know, like these butterflies, I was thinking about it. You know, they made it in a factory, so they all have the same, you know, one's blue, one's green, one's orange. But they all have the same markings. But a monarch butterfly, they're the same, but they're all different. They're all different. Everything. There's diversity. And then, so, it's a fact, it's diversity, it's beauty that there's diversity. And Prabhupada's explanation of why it is so is variety is the mother of enjoyment. Krishna is the best of enjoyers, so there's variety. In Nectar Devotion, we get this understanding of five primary rasas. But the part two of Nectar Devotion is Ujjvala Nilamani. In that Ujjvala Nilamani, I haven't read it, but you know the divisions and subdivisions of the divisions and subdivisions of those subdivisions of the different categories of gopas and gopis, with detailed descriptions of their qualities and their characteristics and their names and their activities, and it's like the diversity is resplendent. you know, or take anything. Khichdi. Everybody makes khichdi differently. It's just khichdi. But then I travel around and see, you know, it's on my menu, khichdi, and it's always different. But it's just khichdi. Nice. You know, do you like it this way or that way? You know, I like variety. Well, variety is nice. It's just, it's how things are. And it's part of the beauty of Krishna's creation. We don't have the same abilities, the same capacities, the same shortcomings, the same strengths, the same weaknesses. We're all different. It's wonderful. Yeah, that's how it is. And I say, so that's how I started explaining life is a good instructor. Even you know, an individual, or any one of us, over a period of time, what you were and what you are and what you will be is not the same. I mean, there's some fundamental things that don't change, but there's transformation. Naturally. There was that young American girl that attended the program for the first time. Then she was sitting all alone, so and sat right in the front, so I thought she wanted to say something, so I spent some time with her. And it was her first time, and I asked her what inspired her to come and what she appreciated. One of the things that she appreciated was your singing. And I said, oh, when she was young, she took voice lessons in classical singing. She said, you can tell, it was really good. But I was thinking as I was saying that, when you were taking those classical voice lessons, you weren't thinking, you know, when I go to Penn State, I'm going to, you know, sing Hare Krishna Bhajans in it, you know, for a group of Americans in State College. The intention of that was very different. The form that it takes. Anyway, so it's things that make up our own individuality. They also undergo some transformation and diversification. That's my point. And you know, today, what my understanding is of devotional service. And, you know, the joys and the struggles of that. It's going to be different tomorrow. Some things may stay kind of the same, but many, many things, even within one individual, what to speak of, you know, just how things are. Different, and it keeps changing. And even in the spiritual world, There's diversity. Endless. It's nice. Embrace it. That's what it is. It's nice. Yes.
Where that's the motivator that I don't want to suffer.
Well, or say it positively, we want to be happy. And the suffering part interferes with happiness, so I don't want that to interfere with my happiness or contentedness or sense of... Bhaktivinoda Thakur addresses it. What you're this topic in a interesting way. He says that there's a world of difference between duty and love. But duty can become love. But it's not just, you know, do it long enough and it becomes love. Duty, using this other metaphor, wet wood, dry wood, duty is like making wet wood, dry wood. But then the dry wood has to be ignited to make it fire. So duty is helps establish goodness, because the way that Kapila Dev describes to Devahuti devotional service in goodness is where one, two things. One does things because it ought to be done. It's duty. It's to be done. Why do I speak the truth? Because you're supposed to speak the truth. You're not supposed to lie. And yeah, you know, lie, there's consequences if I lie. But you should speak the truth because you're just, or whatever, not steal or something. Because it's just to be done or not to be done. Or this will purify my existence. If I do this, this will purify my existence. So it's a more positive. Both are positive. It's to be done, so I do it. Or it will purify my existence. Now, what in that purified state of existence, what's it like? I'm not there yet, so I don't know what it's like. I just know that this will purify my existence. And in the purified existence, I'll be happy and I won't suffer. So I don't. But that fear of suffering is a mode of ignorance influence. And the more the mode of goodness becomes the influencer, it's because it's to be done. And how do I know it's to be done? You know, like the common saying is, well, my mother told me so. Or in Christianity, the Bible tells me so. They have a song. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. How do you know Jesus loves me? Because the Bible tells me. How do I know? You know, the Ten Commandments are true. Well, it's just, they're commandments. They're to be done or not to be done. You just accept it. That's a mode of goodness. Or, a little higher, is this will purify my existence. I want purity. I don't want this contamination. I don't like being dirty. I like being clean. It feels good being clean. I don't like being unclean. And a person in the mode of goodness keeps their... Prabhupada described this, a quality of a worker, a person in the mode of goodness, when they go to their workplace, the first thing they do is make it clean. Like, you know, go in the kitchen. It was the teaching of when you go to the kitchen. Before you even begin cooking, you make the place clean, even if it's clean. You just do it again. You make it very clean. And as you're cooking, you maintain the cleanliness. And when you're done, it's more clean than when you started. That's brahmana, principle of cleanliness. Or say it the other way. You come to a place that's not clean. You can't do your work because it's not clean. You have to, before you begin your work, you have to make it clean. As a mode of passion, I just got to get the work done. Whatever the condition is, I'll do the work. But a mode of goodness person, they can't function in an atmosphere like that. They have to make it clean. It's not compulsion or obsession. It's the mode of nature. Their atmosphere has to be clean. When the mode of goodness is predominating, it's not out of fear if I don't make the place clean, then I'll lose some points. or somebody might see and they might think, oh, what's wrong with this person? They're not being clean, or something like that. Or, you know, whatever the particular application might be. It's in the mode of goodness, one likes knowledge. Not speculation, but one likes knowledge, one likes wisdom, one likes truthfulness, one likes compassion, one likes austerity. Not, you know, just so that it hurts, but it's just, I'm not at all averse to something that's austere. It's nice. I like fasting on fasting days. It's nice. I look forward to it. Not just because if I eat something, then I'll be on a lower grade of devotion or something. The fear principle. But it's because it's to be done. So that's the duty part. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says it's a world of difference between devotional service or something that's done out of duty and something that's done out of love. But the duty is it creates, the mode of goodness creates an atmosphere in which something transcendental can be placed, and that it's a good atmosphere that's something transcendental to grow. Like dry wood, put some fire, you have fire. It will enrich or enhance the fire that you brought in contact with the dry wood. So you can take the chanting of the holy name and place that in this womb or this atmosphere, this environment of goodness, where the predominating feature of goodness is I'm doing because it's to be done. Like, you know, as we heard yesterday, on the order of the spiritual master. So it's obedience. Initially, it's obedience. It may not be out of love. I'm doing simply because I know it's pleasing to my spiritual master. And then that brings it into the realm of love. The mode of goodness is automatically accomplished, and then it's the relationship. Because of, and with that comes protection. And when you're protected, there's nothing to fear. And and what's the basis of that? It's the relationship, and the relationship that's tangible, palpable. I can experience it, feel it. I feel protected, sheltered. From all kinds of things. I mean, bad association things, and bad desire things, and all kinds of things. Protected. Because I'm not going to deviate from that relationship. Not out of fear, but out of love. That's a transcendental relationship. So, most of us don't know how to have a relationship. I'm not, you know, saying one person or other person. My observation over many years in devotional services, most people have never experienced a loving relationship. And if they find one, they don't know what to do with it. And they kind of like, you know, put it over there because I don't know what that is. Or they don't know how to reciprocate with it. That's okay. But when there is a loving relationship, a transcendental loving relationship, it's very nice, and it's very different than out of fear when one becomes fearless. There's a sense of fullness. Not a sense of neediness, but a sense of fullness. It's what we want. without exception, everyone wants. So the starting point of your question was, this is one of two that you see as types of impersonalism, at least conditioning, maybe impersonalism. But to do something out of duty because of the fear that if I don't do it, something bad's going to happen, or I'll be unhappy or I'll suffer. That's, from my experience or perspective, that's a mode of ignorance motivator. And the way to address that is move to the mode of goodness. Just select from the menu, select the mode of goodness. Do something because it ought to be done. It's uplifting. It will bring purity. It will bring that which is, it will bring light. It will bring happiness, not just, I won't have to suffer. Move into that realm. Mode of goodness. Menu selection. And ideally, this is something that's an investment in my relationship with my spiritual master and with Krishna. I'm investing in this relationship through this activity. Then that's, if that's where your consciousness is, that's going to grow, that relationship. The sense of connectedness, and with that the sense of acceptance, and the sense of security and safety. The mode of ignorance influence is gone. The activity hasn't changed. Consciousness behind it has changed by cultivation. You had something?
So this also relates to the presentation that you made yesterday.
Yeah. Every morning.
So there is a very strong impetus, especially when it comes to peace and equality, to kind of just make everything one.
Yeah, smoothie.
So, I mean, it almost seems, you know, if I were to put myself in somebody else's shoes, it almost feels appropriate that in order to have peace, by logic, unless there is oneness, there cannot be peace. And the second part, when I extrapolate it to devotee setting, in terms of services to, and you know, kind of ties in with what Vasana was talking about, is in order to be equal, for example, you know, be equal in terms of services, everybody should do the same services. Or so how does one get out of that that mentality or that loop? Is that impersonalism?
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's you know, the homogenized version of American democracy. We have equal rights. So everyone has to be, you know, cookie cutter, and, you know, do the same thing and so on. Not so. The harmony is with respect. Well, Krishna created variety. They like Chaturvarnamayashristam. So, you know, the head department, the arms department, the belly department, the legs department. They're all needed. It's not like, oh, I can do without you, Mr. Leg. You're not so important because I'm Mr. Head. But we know we need the leg. We value. And we treat with dignity and respect. So while different persons are doing according to their propensity. It's got to come out anyways, even if we try to engineer a smoothie. There's going to be diversity because we have different propensities. It's just God created us that way. It's just how it is. So with respect and show appreciation for the different contributions of service.
Maharaj, and also, I mean, looking at the flip side of that is the understanding that I have certain inclinations, but in devotional service, my capacities can be unlimited, Krishna willing.
Yeah.
So technically, I can do absolutely anything.
Well, at least theoretically, you can do absolutely anything.
Yeah, theoretically. So, how does one balance both of that? Like, respecting inclinations at the same time, understanding that...
The way that Prabhupada addresses it is there's three types of duty. There's prescribed duty, there's emergency duty, and there is preferred duty. So, in an emergency, anybody can do anything. And in the beginning, Prabhupada was operating in emergency mode because he had a short lifespan. He knew it. And he had to establish, a worldwide society. Or that was his mission, his self-established mission. So he had to do lots of things and engage a lot of people in a lot of different ways. Now take away the emergency component, and then there's more of an opportunity to look at individuals' propensity and engage them according to propensity. And when they're engaged according to propensity, they're particularly productive. But emergency may also dictate. It's not that I only do propensity. I do what's needful. And that's a phrase that Prabhupada would use, do the needful. So, some kind of balance, and a lot depends upon the individual and it depends on the circumstance, whether it's propensity or needful. You can say emergency. It's needed. Yeah, but it's not... Yeah, but we need somebody to... So please go do that. Or I may, myself... It's not my propensity to do something, but there's a need. I do things like that. There's a need. Not my propensity. But the need is obvious. So, here goes. Oh, and back to the other side, from the materialist, that there has to be this thing of oneness. What is that oneness? When it's with a given that we're individual, how are you going to have oneness? That's I addressed. We don't abandon our individuality or deny our individuality or try to squash it or pretend it isn't there. The fullness of our individuality, but purified, it brings harmony. It amplifies others' individual. Ness without clashing, provided we respect and provided we apply ourselves at the center. Krishna's interest first. My interest is subordinated to Krishna's interest. My individuality is subordinated to Krishna's happiness. And so, in that dynamic of diverse individuals, but creating a sense of oneness, there's a loving dealing between the individuals who are collectively trying to serve Krishna. And that loving dealing, Prabhupada's phrase, is give and take, love and trust. It's a great sutra. Sometimes our particular brand of, you know, how we like to do things that prevails. And sometimes somebody else's. Like in a marriage or like in any relationship. Sometimes and sometimes I yield. Just, you know, because the relationship is more important to me than prevailing. And it, you know, when the strength of when the relationship is going properly connecting, no one's keeping score. So many times I've submitted my will to your will. It's always like that. And you know, how come you can't be? I get some points over on this side. Not like that. When there's a loving relationship, it's give and take freely. Love and based on love and trust. You trust the other person. And they're trustworthy. That's where you can have oneness. You can have individuality and oneness at the same time. Prabhupada's phrase is unity in diversity. You've heard that phrase. It's in a famous letter that Prabhupada wrote to Kirtanananda. And the reality is there's diversity. Look at the student population. Look at the world. You know, Oriental, African American, Spanish, European, Eastern European, American, Indian, you know. Big mix. I can have oneness. There has to be some, a spiritual basis for it. Not just like a material, everyone's equal basis for it. It's not so. Anything else? Yes?
You were talking about the lotus, basically the whole thing about the knowing the lotus feet of the Lord, like, but I'm saying, like, the closest we have is the deity where we could actually. So, how is it that we see, go from seeing the feet of the Lord to actually understanding that it is the lotus feet of the Lord that we are actually seeing in every one in our deity worship?
So. I don't get your question.
So,
Srimad Bhagavatam has first and second canto. That's also lotus feet. Correct?
Right.
So, that's not our only access to lotus feet, is the deity's lotus feet. That's for starters. The premise of your, you know, the given part of what you said is not exactly. So, how do we connect the first and second canto to the rest of the cantos? It's part of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's the literary form of the Lord. So in the deity, the lotus feet of the deity is, they're certainly connected to the rest of the deity. You're at the lotus feet of the deity and you're at the before the deity. And the lotus feet are part of the deity's form. So what seems perfectly natural and obvious is If the regard is for the lotus feet of the deity, the mood is before the deity, it's reverence and humility. So that's how you approach. You approach with that mood and with, you know, the action of your eyes, and then gradually seeing the other parts of the deity. You know, just doing it in a technical manner. So I'm not sure what your question is, though.
Srimad Bhagavatam is different from any other ordinary book because, I mean,
by the effect. The first is on the authority of, you know, because the scripture says so. But we can use our reasoning faculty to some degree to help us reach the same understanding. It's different than sense perception and reasoning. It's on authority of Shabda. But it's also our experience. You know, like Prabhupada would say about chanting Coca-Cola or Hare Krishna. What there's a difference. There's lots of songs, popular songs, and people sing them over and over and over again. And after some time, you know, they get a new song. And what's the consciousness that arises from singing that song over and over again? It's not the same as what results from chanting Hare Krishna. It's different, the sound vibration. Even if I don't know what the authority is, the experience is different. Subjectively. And subjectively, reading Srimad Bhagavatam doesn't have the effect. I mean, like, take this. You know, Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is, compared to so many other Bhagavad Gitas. And where have those other Bhagavad Gitas produced devotees? There's something about it. How it's presented. Practically speaking.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. By the result. You judge a thing by its result. Anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, in the prayers to Prabhupada, you have that Prabhupada came to us to free us from the Kursa.
Yeah.
So, my understanding of that one was that there are two kind of personalities. One is we are all one, and the other is devotee Krishna from his form and pastimes. Am I right or wrong? Is the culture and religion
that's not the two. The two are impersonalism and voidism. Voidism is, in the ultimate analysis, nothing is. And the other is, it's all one. And that's all there is.
And how do you come to voidism from the Western religions?
How do you come to voidism?
From the Western point of view.
From the Western point of view?
I mean religions of Islam, Christianity.
It's Buddhism. Buddhism is voidism. As far as an ism, but voidism, a Western manifestation of voidism is like existentialism. Just like, it's such a disturbed state of mind. by bitterness of experience, Prabhupada writes in Bhagavad Gita that impersonalism and voidism are born of frustration. My experiences are so bad. And trying to figure it out, I'm so frustrated. Nothing matters. It's existentialism. I exist, but nothing matters. Even my existence doesn't matter. Nothing matters. What's real, nothing's real. Nothing matters. It's like, you know, taking Novocaine or something. I don't like the pain, so I just take some Novocaine. I don't feel anything. Nothing matters.
So, Bharat, I'm not clear on this. Christianity, is it
Well, you know, to say Christ and God are the same is impersonalism. Christ is God. It's impersonalism.
So go back, go to Islam.
I don't know Islam. You do.
Judaism.
Huh?
Judaism.
Oh, you know, God has no name. God has no form. But aside from the institutionalized, you know, enshrinements of those impersonalisms, it's pervasive. Even those that have, you know, have gone far from those institutionalized, how Christ became God, or so-called became God, or is seen as God, it's the influence of impersonalism. Not like it's a brand of Christianity. It's just the impersonal tendency is so strong.
Okay.
even Christianity, where it's very clear. Monotheism, God, Christ becomes God. Huh? Sure. It's called Western and Eastern. And that, you know, the Christian church split in part. One of the splits is that one.
So are they personalists?
No. No. The other is they're just like bewildered. I don't even, you know, I grew up with that kind of teaching. I never bought into it. Just doesn't make sense. Nor is it what Scripture says. God the Father has sent me. That's two. And then they're saying it's one. It's not one. God the Father and I are one. But, you know, how do you put those two things together? God the Father has sent me. The Father and I are one. You know, they just take the Father and I are one and leave the other one aside. You can't do that. They're both there.
They don't say that Christ was a prophet. They say that they're one.
They say so many things. There's so many varieties out in the garden of, you know, speculation. Yes?
They mentioned that demigods don't want their material desires to cloud their vision, so they pray to the Lord.
Mm.
So I understand that to mean that they have a very clear conception of their shelter.
Yes.
So putting your faith in other shelters, say your intellect or your outlook or something like that, does it mean that you're not seeing the devotees of the Lord or the devotee of the Lord? And is it also impersonalism?
If we do what? Is it also impersonalism? Say it again.
We put in others, we have faith in other, we take false shelters maybe, like one's intellect or...
Intellect, okay.
Or maybe like I do a lot of hard work and figure it out or something.
Yeah. It's so what you're asking is jnana and karma a form of impersonalism? Speculative tendency or fruitive work as a means of elevating myself?
Any other shelter.
Or any other shelter. Is it a form of impersonalism? That's your question. It's nice question. In one sense, yes. In another sense, it's not the strict form of what one thinks of as impersonalism. Well, because impersonalism is to the effect of impersonalism is to reduce or eliminate distinctions. So, like Madhvacharya, Dvaitavad, there's distinctions. That's like strongly smashing impersonalism. Distinctions. Like cornerstone of his doctrine, distinctions. So that's the essence of impersonalism, is to blur or to dismiss, like dissolve distinctions. So, intellect doesn't necessarily do that. Karma has a tendency to do that, where I place myself in the position of the controller and enjoyer. So it's no longer I'm the servant of the Supreme, it's I'm the enjoyer. It indirectly has that effect of blurring distinctions. And unless properly guided, both intellect and fruitive tendency as false shelters can easily bring one to the position of impersonalism. Intellect more so. Driven by the desire that brings me to the material world to begin with. I don't want to accept the supremacy of God. Plus, I have an active intellect equals likely an outcome of some impersonal conception. Because with my intellect I can build a rationale that says I can accept my position as being the enjoyer and the controller of, and the be-all of everything. But if one's intellect is even more refined, like Einstein, I find myself like a little child in this vast shore of a vast ocean that is so incredibly beyond my capacity to understand. That's when one's being honest. But intellect can also be very self-deceiving. Anything else? Oh, sorry.
Is it practically possible to have a relationship with other devotees? Should we look for certain...
Say your whole sentence. I can't read your mind.
So whom we know well...
That's natural. Having degrees of confidentiality in relationships is natural. But to feel in a fundamental way, here's a devotee, you may not even know the devotee, or someone I know but I don't have so much interaction with, provided, several things. One is, fundamentally, here's a person who, they have some attraction for Krishna. They're part and parcel of Krishna, and they have some attraction. At least they'd like to reestablish their relationship with Krishna. So there's some appreciation and some respect for that soul. So there's some relationship on that basis. And then there may be others who, here's a devotee that has that quality, and they're really actively pursuing that, and they're, although they may not be a fully purified soul, I see they're very sincerely working towards becoming purified. So there's some greater appreciation, perhaps, for that person. And here's another one I can think of persons that I know that they have some really bad habits, but I know inside there's some attraction for Krishna. So I may keep a distance from that person, but still respect them. And I can have intimate interactions with them. But it doesn't change my respect for them. That there's something inside that's unique. They have an attraction for Krishna. And Krishna will make Krishna purify that person. But I'm not going to... So I'll have far more interactions with and confidential exchanges with the other individual. And then there's some things that just are service... circumstantial. They're more proximate. There's more interaction, and you have more interaction, and wow. It opens doors that weren't open before, just by that common service together. So one of the things that, for example, what you have here with State College, we have this phrase in ISKCON that relationships are suspended on common service together. So you have common service, then it helps establish relationships. Then even after you go to other places, you remember those devotees and those relationships that you had with one another. I've seen it, and it's natural. Whereas there may be many other devotees all over the place that just haven't had those exchanges with of common service. And so you're appreciating their devotees, but it's, you know, the interaction is not the same. Okay. You had something you wanted to follow up. You didn't. Before I went to your husband, you were.
Yeah. No. I just wanted to make sure that you were saying that the motivation of fear is more than that. Once you move over to goodness, where one has it, what did you say again?
Guru and Krishna.
Guru and Krishna and so on. So, in order to
Yeah. Well, there's positive and negative. Anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam. Those are two principles of surrender. That which is favorable for moving forward on the path of bhakti, I accept. Those things that are unfavorable, I reject. So it's two things. One thing is what you said. And another thing is, say no to that mode of nature. No, I'm not going to be controlled by you. I'm not going to be controlled by fear. No. But more important is the positive. Take shelter of those. With every injunction, there's a prohibition. So, nasate vidyate bhavo no bhavo vidyate sataha. That verse from the second chapter, Krishna says, those who are tattvadarshis, they don't place much value in asat, and they place value in sat. So that's a. Then a neutral position is matrasparshastukonteyasitoshnasukadukha. So rather than be attracted to this and repulsed by that, let me remain neutral or just tolerate. So part of that, okay, here's this fear thing. So one option is to say, no, I'm not going to go there. Another is, you just, okay, it's there. I'm just going to, but I'm not investing consciousness in it. I'm just going to tolerate and invest consciousness in this other. Stronger is to say no. But in the course of time, it'll just go away. But at least remain neutral. Don't like let it linger. Because by contemplation, you're giving energy. You're investing consciousness in that fear, although there's no substance to it. Illusion becomes reality. Or bigger than reality, becomes consuming. So minimally is tolerate. Stronger is, excuse me, please sit down. No, right now, just sit down. I'm going to pay attention to mode of goodness over here. That's discipline. That's self-discipline. Control of the mind. Samad Dhamma. Mode of goodness. Characteristic. And you can control the mind by the intelligence. Intelligence says to the mind, my dear mind, don't go there. Go here. Prohibition, injunction. And what's the support is the relationship. The spiritual master in the scripture that I hold faith in. So let me invest in that. And automatically, I'm not going to go there, I'm going to go here. As that relationship is strong. And over time, it becomes the mode of nature that you're influenced by, and the relationship becomes palpable. Not just in that circumstance. And it's not imagined, it's real. It's spiritual reality. It's protection. It's continue, and it's Krishna. Krishna's protection. The relationship with Krishna is established that way. In practical affairs, day-to-day, moment-to-moment affairs, relationship with Krishna, by that method we just described. So there's a sadhana, like we just read from Nectar Devotion, where there's no attachment or spontaneous loving service, but on the order of the spiritual master. I do. It's my duty. But then it's the relationship with the spiritual master. Why do I do what the spiritual master says? Because there's trust and there's love. I accept. You're nurturing that relationship. It lifts one. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.